Good morning. How are you? So as Paul mentioned, I'm Shokan Moy. My driver's license says Eric Moraine. You can call me anything but late for supper, unless we're having peas. I don't. And the robes I'm wearing are not Unitarian ordained robes. These are Zen priest robes, and that's my lineage. But I work here in the Lake Country UU Church. I am a member here, a former board member. And if you like what happens here this morning, consider joining a group of us that meets on Monday evenings. So this morning I want to talk about social justice and why it seems so hard to bring about change, even though we've been struggling with this for hundreds and hundreds of years. It still seems like it's a pervasive problem. And for this morning, I want to kind of do a little bit of vocabulary work first. Social justice, my working definition, is the deliberate and unequal distribution of resource, such as food, money, or influence, which is driven by human desire, not by circumstances external to humans. Driven by human greed, ignorance, anger. And social injustice is a complex question. It's not simply answered. So for this morning's service, I want to focus on only one little component. I want to focus on the money, because this is a capitalist culture. And capitalism, if you haven't noticed, has kind of taken over the planet. And it's the dollars that drive the bus. And so that's going to be the focus. While there are lots of other valuable and important variables that contribute to social injustice, this morning I'm going to focus on dollars, because we all have some. And it turns out what you do with them actually makes a big difference. Karen sang a lovely song this morning. You had me going. Thank you. One of the words in there is actually an Italian word, ghetto. And it turns out it comes from an area in Venice, the Canarego Ghetto. If anybody speaks Italian, you're going to have to correct my pronunciation. So it turns out there were Jews living in a variety of places. Some of them, about 500 years ago, were living in Venice. And there was some political and cultural disparity going on. And eventually, the folks that write the rules about what happened in Venice made up a rule that said all the Jews have to move to the north side of town, to the Canarego Ghetto. That was the name of the neighborhood. And that way, well, we didn't have to see you. We didn't have to hear you talk. We didn't have to eat your food. And maybe we could, like, not have to notice that you were around. Humans have done that kind of kettling, is another phrase for it. That came out of British police control, right? And it's done here in the U.S. as well. When there's social unrest or protest marches, there's an officially designated little spot where you can stand and wave your placard. The police have kettled you into a little area where they can kind of keep control over you, and you can still wave your flag or do what you need to do, but you're kettled, right? And maybe the Venetians were some of the first who actively tried to create geographic kettling. So that happened here in the U.S. as well, mostly in the late 40s, as people were coming over from Europe after World War II. There began to be neighborhoods, right? There was the Irish neighborhood, right? And there were the Italians over there, and the Jewish neighborhood. And that term, ghetto, came along with that culture. And pretty soon in New York City, there were ghettos. After a while, that phrase, that term ghetto, kind of became synonymous with kind of a nasty part of town that wasn't necessarily pleasant to be around or be in. After a while, it's almost synonymous with slum, right? Ghetto and slum kind of became interchangeable. So we made laws and rules about whether that's permissible or not. And in theory, that's all been changed, and that doesn't happen anymore. In practice, I'm proposing it still happens. It's shifted a little bit. And for today's conversation, I want to talk about financial or economic ghettos. We are kettled. We're kind of forcibly stuck into these economic strata, which sometimes align with social strata. And it's difficult to get out of that. It's not something you necessarily ask to be put into. Oftentimes the boundaries are a little bit invisible, and the structure that created that system is greed, anger, and ignorance. And it benefits somebody or some strata that's a layer or two or three higher up than the one you're in. And that's how I propose we're all kind of stuck in a ghetto. Right? Why is this, right? Now, so we look at some of the easily seen stuff, the social injustice where people are extremely poor and struggle to get by, right? Most of us here this morning in this room typically have enough food in the fridge, and we can make a go of it day to day and week to week. There are folks that have a really hard time doing that. Why is that? Why is it so hard to make that change? And again, I propose it's because of kind of these unseen economic forces that have gradually crept in and created a system that benefits the few at the expense of the many. And the few accumulate more power or wealth, and they experience less of what they don't want to experience, which is oftentimes the consequences of their actions. Why hasn't it stopped? Well, it's not very easy to make it stop. Taiwan has been trying. I think I heard a count yesterday. It's in the 26th week of protests in Taiwan. They are trying to make a change. We here in this community have been trying to make a change for quite a long time by being involved in the Black Lives Matter process and protest. It hasn't changed quite enough yet. Why? Because enough of us haven't decided to make it change. The human propensity for mental stuckness is why we continue to suffer in the way we are. The insight that we don't notice what we're thinking and therefore are unable to change how we're thinking is the turning point that was the awakening moment for Buddha, for that guy 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama, right? The light bulb went on and he says, oh, I not only have to change what I do, I have to change how I think because I'm stuck. And the stuckness creates attachment to the things I like and aversion to the things I don't. He described it as the root of all human suffering. And I propose what we need to do is have that aha moment, that awakening, that enlightening, turning on the light. We need to wake up to our stuckness and wake up to the reality of that somewhat hidden structure that maintains these injustices. And much of that structure is financial, and much of it is hidden from casual view. But that doesn't mean it can't be seen. You have to learn how to open your eyes, and I'm hoping that I can do a little bit of that this morning. The soil in which the root of stuckness grows is fear. Fear of change is what keeps us stuck in our habitual patterns. A very small expression of fear might be the last time you were surprised by too many peas. Right? Or maybe that assigned spot for parking in the work parking lot has a car in it when you show up this morning and you can't park in your assigned spot. What's the instant reaction? Wait. And then you might slide into something else, sadness, anger, concern, whatever that is. But the first reaction, that millisecond is, I'm surprised. That's an expression, a low-grade expression of fear. Those examples might not be your daily life examples, but you have some, I'm sure of them. Fear of not enough. Fear of no longer being a part of. Fear of not being comfortable, fear of losing what you have, fear of not getting what you'd like, fear that somehow others who are struggling for their very survival will impact your ability to survive. My Zen training teaches me that greed, anger, and ignorance strongly influence our actions. They are the three poisons of the human mind. Carl Jung, the German psychologist, has said that those kinds of influences most often happen below our level of conscious awareness. They are in shadow. I don't notice that it's happening to me, and yet it influences what I do and what I say and how I act. Greed, anger, and ignorance mostly operate in shadow. It's very seldom that we find someone who purposefully, deliberately, with conscious and malice aforethought, acts in a greedy manner. There are a few. I don't want to point out those examples this morning, right? You see them on the news. For the most part, it's below conscious awareness, and yet it happens. The greedy ones create those financial systems where we stay ignorant of the structure or the consequences of our actions inside that structure. We end up being stuck participating in it, unwitting participants. My kind of derogatory word is we become sheeple, right? We're a herd of sheep, which is kind of directed along the path. Buy this, don't buy that. Say this, don't buy that. Join this, don't buy that. Join this. We never stop to look underneath that veil of ignorance. Why? Media is training us to do this, right? That's what we're constantly fed an endless diet of on Facebook, on Instagram, on the commercials. We're being trained to become afraid of immigrants, unions, the working poor. Really? Are these the people who created the system? Or are these the folks that are victims of the system? If you can't see it, you can't do anything about it. Our eyes are being directed towards taking action in areas that have no influence. And so the folks who've created the system continue to benefit from the system because we're reacting in the way they'd like us to react. But we can do something about it. And as an example, I'm going to offer apartheid. It began somewhere around 1948, where it was put into law. Nelson Mandela, a name that we associate with the anti-apartheid movement, was sent to prison in 1964 for standing up against this system of social injustice. And he stayed in prison for a very long time. And there really wasn't a whole lot of change happening yet. There was protest, there was some uprising, and eventually, throughout the 70s and 80s, when I was in school, it started showing up in schools and at universities. Students were protesting and insisting that universities divest themselves and their foundations of investments pertaining to South Africa. Sell the stocks. Don't buy the products. We don't want our university to support apartheid. Get rid of those dollars. Put them into something else. It eventually faded away, but before it did, it produced a change because apartheid did eventually, in time, end. The social injustice continues today in South Africa, not quite in the same way. And I would propose that part of the reason for that change back then was because of this push for divestiture. Take your money out of something you don't support. Don't spend your money on something you don't support. Divestiture works. Voting with your dollars works. There are many ways we can do it. And for this morning, I want to propose that I recruit you to protest with your purchases. Did you know that there are no Walmarts in Germany? Who knew that? There are no Walmarts in Germany. The last Walmart in Germany closed in 2006. They tried. They moved in. They were open. Sales were awful. They had a hard time hiring employees. There were a number of reasons why. The common initial throwaway is, well, we don't like American capitalism. But you know what? That didn't stop Pizza Hut, KFC, and Starbucks, which is all over Germany. But there are no Walmarts. In part because the company politics didn't line up with German sensibilities. How Walmart treated its employees, and in particular, the code of ethics it insisted on from its employees. This is a quote from a HuffPost article. Walmart not only required employees to spy on fellow workers and report any misconduct, it also prohibited intimacy among its employees. Apparently, while the folks running the Arkansas-based company had no problem with screwing the environment, they couldn't abide employees doing that to each other. Walmart tried to open stores in various cities here in the U.S., and they failed. There are no Walmarts in Portland, or San Francisco, or Detroit, or Seattle, or Boston, or Los Angeles, and New York City. Why is that? Walmart needed zoning changes to bring in the hyperstore, the Ultra Center. And places like New York City refused because they recognized it would not be in our long-term best interest to allow you in. They didn't grant the zoning changes. That didn't stop Walmart from trying. They started making substantial contributions to local organizations and nonprofits. Eventually, New York City even went so far as to send corporate headquarters in Bentonville a letter. We're going to refuse your donations. Please stop sending them. They recognized Walmart was trying to buy their way in. And eventually New York City said, no thank you, we're not going to take your money. Divestiture works. There are still no Walmarts inside New York City. Costco, on the other hand, seems to have done fine as a big box retailer. And they haven't seemed to kind of foster the same vitriol that was pushed up against Walmart. Why is that? Maybe it's because they offer a living wage. Maybe it's because they offer benefits and allow unionization to protect its workers' rights, none of which is available at Walmart. Financial leverage is real, even at our tiny, minuscule level. You don't have to be a multimillionaire. We spend our money on and with whom we choose to spend it. That is extremely important in the big picture of things. In fact, it is the picture. This is the system. This is what we're stuck in. And if we choose to change how we spend, we will change the system. The chains that keep social injustice from moving. If those folks had enough money, if we had enough money, it would allow for better prenatal care. It would allow for better health care. It would allow for better sanitation, better education, and eventually greater influence in this larger visible social system that we're still embedded in. So you might wonder, does one person's divestiture, does changing what mutual fund is in your IRA, does that one little thing really matter? Does one person boycotting a store or no longer buying a particular brand, does that actually make a difference? Does one mosquito in your bedroom at night make a difference? And when one talks to a second, and those two talk to two more, and those four talk to four more, that's called geometric growth. That's called it went viral. And all of a sudden, what started out as one mosquito in the bedroom becomes a system that shuts down Walmart in Germany. Does it really matter who you send your package through, UPS or FedEx? Does it really matter whose chicken you buy? So let's just talk about chicken, for example, for a minute. Let's talk about chicken. Hey, yeah? She says yes. Let's talk about Chick-fil-A for a minute. How many Chick-fil-A stores are in the U.S.? Any guess? 2,500 in 2018. And they're on a growth rate That's almost 17% a year. They're now the third largest fast food chain in America, second only to Starbucks and McDonald's. How many Chick-fil-A's are in Great Britain? Take a guess. Zero. Why? Because when Chick-fil-A moved into Great Britain, they were already a known entity by the LGBTQ community in Great Britain. And as they broke ground and as they were building stores, word was already out. And one of the leading groups was Reading Pride that really pushed for local awareness of what this company's values and standards are. Let me read you a quote. This is Dan Cathy, who is chief executive officer for Chick-fil-A. "We support the biblical definition of a family, one man, one woman. We are family-owned, family-led, and married to our first wives. We are closed on Sunday for a reason, and we give God thanks for that reason." Reading Pride made it very clear what the standards of this company were. That first Chick-fil-A that opened in Great Britain, it lasted 8 days, and then it closed because the pressure was relentless. And it wasn't just one mosquito anymore at that point. It was a cloud. And Chick-fil-A realized, we're done. And they moved out. And the growth rate in the U.S. for Chick-fil-A continues to be, last year it was 16.7% growth. Right? We don't have a cloud of mosquitoes shutting down Chick-fil-A. Why is that? Because enough of us don't care to lift the veil of ignorance and vote with our dollars. Ultimately, it's all about the money. Becoming aware of what we are not aware of creates opportunity to shift the unseen into the seen. And once we're aware of a habit, we can change the habit. And once that door of perception is opened, it can't really get closed again. And I want to continue to pry that door open a little bit this morning. Let's stay on the subject of chicken. Is that okay, Bryn? Remember last August, there was a big kerfluffle for a while in the news. There was an ICE raid on some chicken processors in Mississippi, and like 700 people or something got arrested and detained, right? Do you remember that? And it was a big to-do, and it's all about those undocumented immigrant workers that are creating trouble, right? Why did we never hear the names of the people who violated state and federal law, the ones who hired the undocumented workers? Why is it that the poor folks went to jail and awaited deportment, but the rich folks continued to run the chicken processing plants almost without a hitch, almost without a delay? As far as I could tell in the little digging that I did, not a single one of the 7 plants that got raided was shut down for more than a few hours of its production schedule. How's that possible? I even had to dig for a while to find the names of the companies because it never made it to the news, because they didn't really want us to get their names into the news. They wanted us to focus on those illegal immigrants. Right? So here are the names: Pico Foods, Coke Foods, PH Food, MP Food, and Pearl River Food. Ever heard of them? Neither have I. What brands are processed by these factories? Is there chicken that's sold here in Wisconsin that comes from one of these plants? I don't know yet, but I'm hoping one of you will find out, and then I will know. And did you think about what were those illegals doing that they got arrested for? They wanted to be paid so that they could be elbow deep in chicken guts, swinging razor-sharp knives and standing at conveyor belt stations for hours on end every day for $10.80. Oh, it's better, though, because there's a raise after 6 months. You get a 20-cent raise, $11 an hour. They literally risked their lives to have a job where they could be elbow deep in chicken blood for $11 an hour. How did we get to a place where people are willing to risk imprisonment for the chance to have a pretty nasty $11 an hour job? There are lots of stories like this, but I want to dig into this chicken one just a little bit deeper. So in the early 1900s, there was this big exodus from the rural areas in the country to the urban areas in the country. Farmers started moving into town, and they got factory jobs. They got town homes. They might have had a little vegetable plot, but they couldn't raise pigs and, for the most part, chickens in their backyards anymore. They needed to go to the butcher, which is something that they used to do on the farm themselves. And along with needing to go to the butcher for chicken or beef or pork, there was this market that started to develop. More and more people had more and more money, and they wanted to eat more and more chicken, among other things. So they kept going to the butcher, and the butcher needed to buy more chickens, which created factory farming. And factory farming created a need for factory processing of chickens. Who were going to be those people that worked first shift, and then when it got busy, second shift, and eventually three shifts round the clock, processing and butchering chickens so that everybody could eat? Remember Herbert Hoover's American ideal, right? Two kids, a house, a car, a family, and a chicken in every pot. Yeah. Thank you to the American Chicken Growers Association. They snuck that in, right? It worked immensely well. The interest in chickens skyrocketed. The problem was they didn't have enough people to man the factories. So they started marketing to women because they were, at that point, the only untapped employee market. And because it was somewhat food-related, they kind of spun it like, well, you're a homemaker. You know how to cook. Come work in our chicken factory, right? It was a slim fit, but it worked. And they had employees. And the need for chickens continued to grow, and they ran short on employees. And so they went out looking again. And who were the other folks that were kind of underutilized? Sharecroppers. The African Americans, often men. They went out and started recruiting African Americans to now work in the chicken processing plants right next to the Caucasian women. This was still a segregated South in the 40s and 50s. You can imagine that didn't go over well with the ladies. They were angry and upset having to work next to African Americans, and many of them quit. So the idea of bringing in more hired help, because it was the wrong flavor of help, it backfired on the chicken factories. And once again, they were shorthanded. So then they went to one rung lower, if you want to call it that, on the social strata, and they started deliberately, intensely recruiting African-American women. And pretty soon, there were almost no Caucasian women working, and it was pretty much exclusively African-American. And the need for chicken increased because we discovered processed food. We discovered frozen food. We discovered chicken tenders and McNuggets. The need for chicken skyrocketed. And once again, they ran out of employees. Who did they go to now? Who was left in the bottom of the barrel? The next group were the migrant workers because they were only working part of the year, right? They're only there when the tomatoes need harvesting, when the pickles need picking, when the cotton crop has to come in. And the rest of the time, they had to move on and find another field to work in. And for some of them, it became an improvement to move into a chicken factory and be elbow deep in chicken guts all day. It was a steady job, and what they needed was money so that they could lift their families and their children up, hopefully to a slightly higher social strata. And that's where it was at last August when ICE came and raided. And they ran into that same old problem of not having enough labor. But this time it was the federal government that did it, because in that one day, eight plants owned by five companies were raided and 700 employees were moved because of immigration violations. So, of course, the companies, in order to keep production running, they had to take matters into their own hands. And they decided to raise wages and provide better working conditions and better benefits and attract the sort of people looking for a decent paying job who might not have wanted to work there before because they improved working conditions. No, I'm just kidding. thanks to Stephen Colbert. What they really did was they appealed to the Mississippi State Legislature for help. And Mississippi came through big time. You know what they did? They bussed in prisoners. And in a matter of a few hours, the production lines were up and running again. And chickens were going in the front door, and frozen packages of chicken were going out the back. Mississippi provided prison labor for chicken processing plants to fill those vacant jobs. It was a great solution because prison labor is even cheaper than undocumented labor. Do you know what the prisoners get paid? 86 cents an hour is the average wage for prison labor, 86 cents an hour. And they don't need health care because that's provided by the federal government. They come with their own security force, and they're really dependable. They show up every day because the guards make sure they can't go away. Everybody wins. Maybe. And it's quite possible that the chicken on your dinner plate was put there by slave labor. This system got broken when the Civil War happened, and now we're back again to the same kind of system that we rebelled against back then, slave labor. And it exists again today. And the chicken processing industry is only a small example of it. It shows up in many other places. But you have to dig. You have to be willing to ask and look into it and find out, where is it? Where is it? So my Zen heritage tells me to take refuge in this awakening community and our realization in the truth of the interconnection, interpenetration, and interdependency of all sentient and insentient beings everywhere. That is a third of the three refuges. My UU heritage tells me to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. It's the seventh UU principle. In fact, it's painted on one of these pillars. Take a look for it as you leave today. The time for us to change is now. We are the ones who are going to make this change happen, and we're going to do it now. Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And so, ushers, when you're ready, I want us to share with each other just a 15-second soundbite. What brand of gasoline do you buy and why? What fast food chain do you avoid? Why? What brand of clothing do you buy? Because why? Does it matter which accounting firm you choose? I'd say yes, based on this week's headlines about what happened at Ernst & Young, right? Some people, I propose many of you, have investigated some tiny little thing in your life and are already voting with your dollars. I really believe in the collective wisdom of a community. And now I want, please, just 15 seconds or so. What is it that you know? Are you willing to raise your hand and share what is it that you do or have stopped doing? Right? Who's willing to try offering something? Jim.
Yes, it reminds me, and I've tried to live this for years, that every dollar you spend is a vote for the kind of world you want to see, therefore avoiding the Koch brothers, Procter & Gamble, Nestle's, and the list is longer.
Thank you.
This is Phil. Real briefly, I'm involved in actions on climate change, and I'd like everybody to double-check their mutual funds and make sure you're not invested in the Exxons of the world, oil, coal, fossil fuel industry.
Awesome, thank you. Who else has made a conscious choice about what you're buying or not?
I have years ago already ordered my financial advisor only social responsible investing, and the one that just retired a few years ago, I was with him. And I was reading about some gold company in Africa and how they were abusing the environment and the people. And I thought, wait a minute, I have those stocks. And I called him, and he said, yes, and they've done this, blah, 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 right? I said, get rid of them right this minute. And I really got angry. From awesome. That moment on, there was no more playing Great. Around like that.
Great. Thank you so much. Yeah. Who else? What are you buying?
So one of the things that I avoid is Starbucks.
And, Starbucks.
Course, has a... Well, the most recent reason was my daughter had gone to Costa Rica earlier this year on a foreign language program, and they had visited coffee fields, and they talked extensively about coffee and fair trade and whatnot. And she came back, and maybe this was more widely known, I didn't know it, was that Starbucks is able to say Costa Rican coffee even if they put like a fraction of a bean from Costa Rica in it. Mm. So okay. In Costa Rica, Starbucks has these tiny, tiny fields just so they can put a very small portion in it. And I just, you know, all the other reasons to dislike Starbucks, it's just so deceptive.
Great.
So
thank yeah. you. Thank you. Maybe two more. Go ahead.
So whenever we can, we purchase our clothes from Patagonia because they do a great job compensating their workers across all their factories, and they do things like use recycled down instead of harvesting more down. So that's what we do.
Awesome. Buy Patagonia. One more.
As probably most people in this audience, I avoid Chick-fil-A. But to be noted on them, there was a large protest against them to, you know, avoid them because of their practices. But it was a counter protest, if you want to call it, that actually say, hey, go buy it because we endorsed her. It's from the far right wing saying that, you know, this is their religious freedom to do that.
Thank you. So those of you who are listening, find the people who were speaking in the social hall today. Ask them more about what they're doing and why. If you didn't raise your hand and grab a microphone, maybe you want to mention to someone, here's something that I do. Here's why I no longer buy BP gasoline, right? Or something else that you're doing. If we were a community, what would it look like? Let's start acting like one. If we functioned as one of those small group of thoughtful, committed citizens and shared with one another what we've learned, our economic power to change the world will make it so. And in closing, I want to quote Jimmy Carter. My faith demands that I do whatever I can, wherever I can, whenever I can, with whatever I have to try to make a difference. I want your faith to do the same. So be it.